The pyramids of Egypt, the cherry blossom festival in Japan, the Taj Mahal, all must-visit wonders found in travel guides like A Thousand Places to See Before You Die. Okay, so what about Garbage City outside of Cairo or the annual Poison Oak Show in Columbia, California? These destinations are chronicled in a new guide called 101 Places Not to See Before You Die.
I wanted to create a kind of get-off-the-hook list for people like me who see a list and feel like they have to do everything on it. So this is a book where you don't have to do everything, and some things on it you couldn't do even if you wanted to try.
Catherine Price has written for The New York Times and Salon. Now she's conjured up 101 places that should be scratched off everybody's bucket list. It seems to be these things not to do fall to some degree into categories, and one of those might be odd places to sleep. Tell us about one of the worst places to sleep.
Well, I guess I had a couple on the list, but one that springs to mind is just the general concept of any hotel that used to be a prison. And there's one of those in Latvia, Karostas Sietums is the phonetic pronunciation. And it's basically this former Soviet-era prison in Latvia that now has been opened up as a hotel. And it's not like they took the prison and then tried to like spice it up and make it into a luxury resort. They basically market it on the idea that 150 people were shot there and you can sleep on iron beds and you can put your kids in a prison bunk bed for the night. You can actually hire them to do an abduction at your workplace and then have you delivered to the hotel. What I think what appealed to me about that, and this is true for many of the entries in the book, is that they walk the fine line between places you genuinely wouldn't want to see. Like, why would I want to really know what it was like to be a prisoner in this horrible place? But also places that are kind of interesting. You know, it's like part of me kind of wants to check that out just so I'd have the story afterwards.
Well, there's another place that could be similar experience to that is the third infiltration tunnel at the DMZ. That would be the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea. Why don't you tell us about this site?
Sure. That was actually a really interesting experience. I was doing a project in Korea and I had the opportunity to visit the DMZ. And I would have thought this was like a Berlin Wall type thing, but it's actually more of a sidewalk curb dividing North and South Korea. And then there's soldiers on either side just staring at each other. But what happens on the tour is that you put all your stuff into a cubby and they give you this helmet and then they put you on this little train. And if you're like me, you're kind of like lulled into complacency because it kind of seems like a Disneyland ride. And then all of a sudden, with no explanation, they take you down into this narrow, claustrophobic tunnel blasted into solid rock that the North Koreans had blasted, presumably as a potential way to invade.
I like the detail, though, that you mentioned where the North Koreans were trying to pretend that this was a coal mining tunnel.
Yes.
So they'd like painted it, parts of it black.
Yeah, they're like, no, it's not actually to invade. It's a coal mine. And then it's a really bizarre place to be.
One of the destinations that I don't think anyone would have really high expectations for is in Beijing, and it's the Beijing Museum of Tap Water.
Yes, it's a museum dedicated to the history of Beijing's tap water, and you can go in and see artifacts from the early days of Beijing's tap water system, which started in 1908. You can see coupons people used to have to bring to the water stations in order to get the water. You can see stethoscopes that were used to listen for leaks in the pipes. But what I find the funniest thing about this is that Beijing's water is actually not safe to drink from the tap.
Another something that begins with the mundane. There's also the Seattle Gum Wall, which is apparently visited by quite a few people on a regular basis. But in fact, it's a place you would say don't go.
I think I would genuinely say don't bother with the Seattle Gum Wall before you die. I think that I don't even need to give any qualifications there. I mean, it's exactly what it sounds like. It's a wall where people have put gum. I don't know, if I'm sitting in the movie and I feel under the seat and I touch a piece of chewed gum, my response is not, wow, I really wish I could see a whole wall of more of that. Yeah, I don't think it's really necessary to visit.
We're talking to Catherine Price about her book, 101 Places Not to See Before You Die. Now, I gather you got in trouble at least about one of these destinations, and that's the Blarney Stone in Ireland.
Oh, yeah. Got in big trouble for that. I'm also in trouble with Nevada because I included the entire state. But for the Blarney Stone, when I hear about a destination whose main attraction is giving you the chance to kiss a piece of stone that's been kissed by hundreds of thousands of people, that is not something that I personally need to do. But as you can imagine, the tourist board, and in particular the marketing department of the Blarney Stone, was not really excited to hear that that was on the list. I actually had a very sweet exchange with the woman in charge, and she would like me and therefore all of our listeners to know that you can actually request a special cleaning of the stone before you kiss it if you would like.
So you're actually traveling right now in Europe. Tell us if you found some new places to add to your list.
Yes, so I'm actually on a really exciting trip with my husband right now. And one place I wouldn't recommend is I just went to the Turin Museum of Anatomy. I don't know if you've heard of this.
No, but anatomy's giving me a funny feeling already for some reason.
Right, so this is basically like a big room with all these glass cases with dried out body parts in them. There are like fingers preserved in formaldehyde, there are desiccated lungs, intestines. And most bizarrely, there's this skeleton sitting there of the guy who founded the museum because he left him a note in his will saying, "I don't want to be buried. I don't want to be cremated. I want to be preserved using the techniques that I myself developed and be put on display in the museum." So there's this skeleton with his brain preserved by his own methods sitting at his feet. Very weird. I enjoy talking about it, but I don't think on a hot Turin afternoon it was really something I needed to do.
Catherine Price, whose new book offers a guide to 101 places not to see before you die. And at npr.org, we've posted photos of some of those very destinations so you can take a look at the Seattle Gum Wall.
From NPR News, this is Morning Edition. The supervisory engineer is Kevin Langley. Our technical director is Brian Jarbo. Audio engineers include Arthur Halliday-Laurent, Greg Gabin, Vince Muse, Ted Mebane, Kurt Stallnaker, Gary Henderson, Stacey Abbott, and Renee Pringle.
With Theo Mondel here at NPR West. Our executive producer is Madalika Sicka. The executive director of news programming is Ellen McDonald. Morning Edition's theme music was written by B.J. Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. Steve Inskeep will be back with us on Monday. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.
It's hard to find an exact date to mark the anniversary of the start of the financial crisis, but today is perhaps as good as any. It was 3 years ago, on August 27th, that the National Association of Realtors announced a major drop in existing home sales. That sent stock prices falling, and you know the rest. NPR's Planet Money partnered with the investigative reporters at ProPublica to look at why the crisis became so bad. NPR's Adam Davidson has this story.
I'm going to cut to the chase and tell you our conclusion first. We believe we can show that some folks on Wall Street had evidence a year or two before the crisis hit that there were serious problems with subprime mortgage investments. Rather than wind down this business, they sped it up using financial trickery. These folks earned huge bonuses for their actions. They also made the crisis larger and more damaging. All right, let's set the scene. The folks we're talking about work in the CDO department of big Wall Street banks.
The CDO department in a bank was the sexiest place to work on Wall Street.
That's Jake Bernstein, one of the two ProPublica reporters who helped uncover this story. CDOs, collateralized debt obligations by their official and confusing name, were the primary way that big banks turned those subprime mortgages into what we now think of as toxic assets. But back in 2006, they were just the hot new part of the finance industry.
It attracted a young group of people, people who were enamored with computer models and believed that they had created a perpetual money machine, that the party would never end. They worked hard, and when bonus time came, they made a lot of money.
They could make bonuses in the millions of dollars. It all depended on how many CDOs they sold. I think of a CDO as a bit like a sausage. You take meat nobody wants, toss it in a grinder, out comes something delicious. With CDOs, you buy a bunch of unattractive subprime mortgage-backed bonds, put them all together, then sell off pieces of this new structure. And like sausages in a diner on Sunday morning, CDOs were incredibly popular.
CDOs, they are the heart of the American boom. Everyone wants them. Pension funds, insurance companies, small banks around the world. Everybody wants it. They can't make them fast enough.
That's Jesse Eisinger, the other ProPublica reporter on this story. He says that for 4 or 5 years, CDOs grew dramatically.
Then in the summer of 2006, it seems like the joyride might be coming to an end.
What happened was, for the first time, lots of customers started saying no to the bankers selling CDOs. Customers like Peter Nowell with the Royal Bank of Scotland.
There were a lot of things that were being relaxed on a credit perspective over that time as people wanted to push out more and more deals. Too many California mortgages, too low credit scores.
Customers kept saying, we'll buy the good parts of the CDOs, but not the worst 10 or 15%. Jesse Eisinger.
This is a big problem for Wall Street because Wall Street has the assembly line going, and any hitch is going to be a big problem. It's going to stop the fees and those bonuses at the end of the year.
At first, Noel says, CDO salespeople tried to convince him, don't leave, buy some CDOs.
It was definitely the hard sell. Frequent calls, wanting to take you out for dinner, and encouraging you to invest early and invest often.
The hard sell wasn't working. Eisinger says that no matter what they did, the investment banks were stuck with the least attractive bits of their CDOs.
What's happening is it's piling up and piling up and piling up. And so they have a big problem. They've got it all coming in through one end, and it's harder and harder to get it out the door. So they need to figure out how to sell this, how to move it out of there.
This is where the trickery comes in. To explain it, let's go back to the sausage analogy. I'm going to be a sausage maker. Here's my handy meat grinder. I'll turn that on. My sausage is selling great. Until one day, my customers start to say, you know what, we like the nice bits in the middle, but we don't like those nasty, knotty parts at the end. Pretty soon, I've got all these end bits piling up on my counter. Nobody wants it, and I'm worried my customers are going to be turned off to the whole sausage business. I'm losing money. So what do? I shove those nasty end bits back in the grinder and make new sausages. Brilliant. Of course, customers don't want the nasty end bits of those new sausages either, so I take those, throw them back in the grinder. You get the picture. This works for a while, but eventually I'm making sausages that are made up almost entirely of nasty end bits.
So this is exactly what happened with subprime CDOs. The investment banks take the worst parts of the CDO and they put it into new CDOs, recycling it again and again until pretty soon the CDOs that you're left with are made up of the worst parts of this stuff.
With Wall Street, when they recycle a CDO, when they shove those nasty bits back in the grinder, they mark it as a sale, as if they found a real customer.
From the outside, it looks like, oh my God, the business is booming. In fact, a lot of the business is an illusion. The CDO guys are orchestrating the demand.
What we're describing here did not cause the crisis. By mid-2006, we already were well into a housing bubble that was surely going to burst and cause financial pain. But by delaying the onset of the crisis and allowing another year of bubble expansion, this financial trickery made the crisis bigger and more painful. We asked the banks involved for comment. A spokesman for Merrill Lynch said the company has a new owner, Bank of America, and they're not going to comment on actions taken under the previous ownership. A Citigroup spokesperson told ProPublica that they cannot comment because the Securities and Exchange Commission is investigating. Adam Davidson, NPR News.
To read ProPublica's account of exactly how Wall Street banks created fake demand, visit ProPublica.org. And you can find a link at npr.org/money. You'll also find Planet Money and ProPublica's collaboration with the Gregory Brothers, the guys known for their musical spoofs. They took real tape of bank executives and, using audio trickery, created a song. So joining the Gregory Brothers, there's Brian Moynihan, CEO of Bank of America, and Robert Rubin, former Treasury Secretary and Chairman of Citigroup. Here's an excerpt.
No one involved in the housing system foresaw dramatic and rapid depreciation in home prices.
No one.
Lenders.
Nobody.
Rating agencies.
Anybody.
Investors.
Somebody.
Insurers. Consumers. Regulators. Policymakers.
So you didn't see it coming at all.
And then when you look back, you always look back and you look back. And you say, well, these were warning signs. And then when you...
In the field of astronomy these days, it is raining planets. Two leading teams of planet hunters, announced this week they'd found entire solar systems, one with two or three planets, the other with as many as seven. These are not planets that could sustain life, but many scientists say detecting such planets is looking more likely. NPR's Dan Charles has more.
Many of the world's experts on planets in outer space are playing top this at a scientific conference in southeastern France this week. Among them is Matthew Holman from the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics.
There's always an element of competition. You know, people come and want to show their best work, and they want to surprise their colleagues.
Holman had to keep his own surprise under wraps for a few days because it hadn't yet been published. So he just listened as his European competitors claimed the spotlight. Christoph Lovis from the University of Geneva in Switzerland announced on Tuesday his group had discovered a whole collection of planets orbiting a star 127 light years away.
At least five planets and probably seven. Two of them are still a little bit uncertain.
It's the largest solar system ever seen outside our own. Now, Lovis didn't really see any of those planets. So far, that's impossible. He watched stars very carefully as they move through space. If they speed up or slow down a little in a regular pattern, it shows there's something tugging on them, the gravitational pull of an orbiting planet. This has been the most successful planet hunting technique, but it works best for giant planets close to small stars. Of the 500 planets discovered so far, most have been like this. One of the new planets that Lovis announced, however, appears to be much smaller. Its mass is just 40% greater than Earth.
We've really moved from giant planets only to any kind of planetary system with more and more planets, small mass planets, and so on. It's really exciting.
And yesterday, Matthew Holman finally got to add his bit of excitement when his discovery was published by the journal Science.
We're announcing the discovery of two Saturn-sized planets, which we call Kepler 9b and Kepler 9c.
And there's evidence of a third planet, he said, a much smaller one. Its diameter appears to be just 50% larger than Earth's.
If it is confirmed, it would have a radius of about 1.5 times the radius of the Earth.
Holman's discovery, in fact, is an early scientific harvest from NASA's new planet-finding machine, a telescope called Kepler. This instrument is following Earth in its orbit around the Sun, staring constantly at a group of 100,000 stars in another corner of our galaxy. When the light from any of those stars dims slightly, it's evidence that a planet just crossed in front of it. Now, the planets that scientists have found so far are not what you'd call habitable. The small ones are way too close to their stars. But Kepler was designed specifically to detect planets just like Earth. And Alan Boss, an astrophysicist at the Carnegie Institution of Washington, is increasingly confident those planets are out there.
We're finding more and more evidence that Earth-like planets are going to be quite common. We don't have them yet, but we're well along the way towards discovering them.
We'll all have to be patient, though. A planet just like Earth crosses in front of its star once a year, and scientists won't declare it a planet until they see the star's light dim at least three times. Dan Charles, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Within 10 years, there could be a shortage of 45,000 primary care physicians. That's one prediction, at least. And one possible solution is to increase the number of highly trained nurses and physician assistants who do primary care. We've been focusing on this most basic health care this week, and once again, I'm joined by NPR's Julie Robner. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Robert.
The shortage of primary care professionals is particularly bad in large rural states, yes?
Absolutely. You know, people are having trouble all over the country finding someone to give them primary care, but it is definitely worse in rural areas. According to the journal Health Affairs, 21% of the nation's population lives in rural America, but only 10% of the doctors practice there.
Earlier in the week, you talked about the fact that the new federal health law will extend health insurance to tens of millions more people. So does that law do anything about boosting the supply of primary care doctors?
You know, it really does. Lawmakers knew that there was going to be this shortage and that they were going to add to it with the people who are getting insurance. So the law increases payments for health professionals who provide primary care now. The law doubles funding for community health centers that provide care in areas where there are shortages of health services. And it also increases funding for programs that train students to become health professionals in the future.
You're using the phrase health care professionals, health professionals, not doctors. You mean more than just doctors.
That's right. As American patients, most of us are used to getting our primary care from someone we call doctor. But increasingly, primary care is being delivered by what's called mid-level professionals. These are people like physician assistants and nurse practitioners. They have more training than a registered nurse, but less than a full-fledged doctor. There are just over 200,000 PAs and NPs practicing today around the country. And in many states, they can practice on their own. They can write prescriptions and do many of the things that a doctor does.
And that's what today's story is about?
Yes, I spent a day with a physician assistant in rural Maine, a part of rural Maine where it's been very difficult to attract doctors, I might add.
Okay, thanks, Julie. And here is the concluding part of Julie Robner's series this week about the crisis in primary care.
It's a little before 6 a.m., and Jim Love is taking the long way to work. Most of the tiny town of Pittsfield, Maine, population 4,200, is still asleep as he pedals his bike through the cool, tree-lined streets. He stops at the local park to check on a mother loon that nests every year at the foot of the same dam.
See the loon? Sitting in the grass?
Ever the caregiver, he's worried that no eggs have hatched yet.
A chick, it's going to be hard to get raised and get out of here in time before cold weather.
Love, who looks younger than his 62 years, gets back on his bike and heads up the hill to his office, just down the street from the local hospital. He knows these will be the last quiet moments of what he expects will be a very long day. Once inside, he checks out the schedule on his computer.
So far today, we're booked for 22 patients, and the phone line hasn't opened up yet.
When it does open, he says, the remaining slots at his clinic, Sebasticook Family Doctors, will fill quickly.
My inbox just turned red, so that means two patients are now scheduled in for the 7 o'clock slot. And looking ahead, starting at 9 o'clock, I'm booked pretty solid from 9 a.m. right through noon. Five of those are new patients that I haven't seen before.
That's because the doctor who used to practice with them in the clinic quit a week earlier. So Love is seeing many of that doctor's former patients as well as his own.
Good morning. How are you?
My ears have been buggy.
But Love isn't a doctor himself. He's a physician assistant, though most of his patients ignore the distinction between a PA and an MD.
99% of them call me doctor, just because it's easier that way.
Of course, to watch Love in action, it's easy to forget he's not an MD.
Now, how often do you check in your sugars at home?
Twice a day.
Twice a day?
Yeah, one at night.
What's the lowest you've gotten?
And most of his patients, at least on this day, don't seem to care what his title is. Robert Marshman is from nearby Exeter, Maine.
Tell you what, I think he's better than any medical doctor I've been to. And I've said that to everybody I've talked to.
Love planned to become a doctor, but he couldn't get into medical school out of college. He worked for several years as a registered nurse instead. When he decided to go back to school in the mid-1970s, he was urged to go to medical school. But with a wife and child, he was put off by the financial obligation that would mean.
It just simply was not, at that stage in my life, feasible. I didn't have the money.
So he became a physician assistant. PAs get training that's similar to what doctors get, just less of it. The average PA program lasts just over 2 years. And he's good at what he does, in part because he knows his limits.
I'm good. I'm experienced. I'm confident. And all that kind of good stuff. I'm not an internist. And I tell my patients that. I just don't bring the same sophistication that a really skilled internist. And I shouldn't.
Love says he thinks people like him, PAs and other so-called mid-level practitioners, are a big part of the solution to the nation's shortage of primary care providers.
We are ideally suited for it. And so cost-effective compared to any other form of medical provider. So we need to be educating a lot more of us.
And not just in rural areas, but increasingly everywhere.
You know, whether it's PAs or nurse practitioners, they are going to be an integral part of the sort of the new horizon in medicine.
That's Michael McDonald. He's the primary care doctor who supervises Jim Love. But they don't work in the same building. McDonald works at another branch of Sebasticook Family Doctors about 25 miles up the road in Dexter, Maine. They communicate primarily by phone and email, and each has his own separate group of patients.
It works out well. It helps our patients get access to care and, you know, and provide good quality medicine.
It's already a pretty typical arrangement in rural America. And as the number of primary care doctors goes down and the number of mid-level practitioners rises, it's becoming more common in urban areas too. But McDonald hopes his mid-level providers don't start streaming to the city. He says he couldn't run his primary care practice without the services of his physician assistant and nurse practitioners. Sebasticook Family Doctor serves some 8,000 patients from 20 rural towns in four counties in central Maine.
It's been very difficult to get MDs to come to the area, or if they do, they don't stay for very long and they leave. All of our nurse practitioners and PAs have been here almost since the beginning, since we've started.
Jim Love, in fact, has lived in Pittsfield for more than 20 years, and he says he has no intention of leaving, at least not until he retires.
I really am dedicated to this practice and taking care of the people we take care of. I really want this to succeed. Hey there. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing better.
It's now nearing 11 a.m. in Pittsfield. Jim Love is greeting his 11th or maybe 12th patient of the day.
Okay, you're taking the 400 and the 200 both at bedtime?
Yeah.
And no matter how dedicated you are, some patients are more challenging than others. Like this new patient he's seeing for the first time.
She's truly above my pay grade. She's got a whole host of serious psychological and physical ailments. I'm really not comfortable treating her.
But Love says he'll continue being her primary caregiver because she has no place else to go. He'll consult with his supervising doctor and specialists as needed. It's what makes his life both so rewarding and so overwhelming. He's hoping the practice will find a replacement for the doctor who just left, and he's hoping it will be a doctor. But even if it's another PA or a nurse practitioner, he'll be glad to have another set of hands to share the load. Julie Rovner, NPR News.
Any day now, 6,000 elementary teachers here in Los Angeles will see their names published online, along with data showing how much their students improved on standardized tests. The Los Angeles Times has promised to release the information to help parents measure how effective the teachers are. As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, the database has sparked a debate on how to evaluate teachers.
The Times stories use some fancy number crunching to compare the effectiveness of teachers in the nation's second largest school system. It has led to an explosive controversy in the city. Some argue it's about time parents had an objective measure to compare their kids' teachers. Others say this is just a way to humiliate educators.
We are outraged that the Times would put this out and put people in harm's way.
A.J. Duffy is president of the United Teachers of Los Angeles. So far, the newspaper has only published analyses of individual teachers and schools. The union has tried to get out in front of the story by publishing critiques of the method used to compare the scores. It's known as the value-added method because it compares test score gains or declines.
At this point, value-added is so flawed that I could not agree that it would be a useful tool.
A.J. Duffy has received some support from researchers who agree the value-added approach is open to error and that those mistakes could lead parents and administrators to the wrong conclusions. A number of papers over the past year have cautioned that there are just too many variables in student performance to rely heavily on student test scores. Tim Sass of Florida State University says there are dozens of factors outside a teacher's control that can limit improvement in test scores. For example,
the principal always gives the weaker students to the new teachers, let's say, and tends to favor their more senior teachers at their school.
The LA Times analysis carefully tries to correct for that and for many other variables. And in fact, value-added analysis is a well-accepted approach that has been used for decades in education research, though not for the purpose of publicly comparing individual teachers. William Sanders, one of the fathers of value-added, now works for a research company called SAS. Sanders says value-added analysis can accurately single out star performers or ineffective teachers. But as to those in between,
can you distinguish within the middle? No, you can't. Even with the most rigorous, robust value-added process that you can bring to the problem.
And Sanders worries that parents may come to the wrong conclusions about those middle performers. The Los Angeles Unified School District admits it has been sitting on this data and hasn't used it to help teachers improve. Now, Deputy Superintendent John Dacey says the real tragedy would be if all this information were simply ignored.
So you would never evaluate a teacher on only using this metric.
On the other hand, you wouldn't, in my opinion, evaluate a teacher completely not considering how students are doing over time in achievement.
Stacy says the controversy is now spurring the district to develop a new teacher evaluation system that uses value-added data. Union President A.J. Duffy says slow down.
They can't. It has to be negotiated.
The two sides have agreed to sit down and talk. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
When school starts next month in Los Angeles, the doors will open at what's been dubbed the Taj Mahal of public schools. The Robert F. Kennedy Community Schools in downtown L.A. cost close to $600 million. That makes it the most expensive in the country. Supporters say the money was approved in 2006 when Taj Mahal might have felt a little bit more like a compliment.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. Until recently, owning a home was a hallmark of the upwardly mobile. Now it's often a shackle. About a third of homes are worth less than what is owed on the loan, leaving many people stuck. Yesterday, we heard about how this is affecting the job market. Today, NPR's Yuki Noguchi looks at the toll this lack of mobility takes on the personal lives of those who can't afford to move.
In 2007, a young couple engaged to be married bought a three-bedroom house in Burnsville, Minnesota for $159,000. A year later, the wedding invitations were ready to go out, but their relationship had fallen apart. But they still have their house.
Every time I'd come home, it was heartbreak because you're coming home to the person whose heart you just broke.
Kelly Christensen is one half of the former duo. 2 years after the breakup, her wedding dress hangs in her ex's closet. He lives across the hall. They really want to move away, but they cannot afford to sell the house for what it's worth now.
There is no way I would have thought this would happen, and no way I would have thought that my everyday practically was defined by the fact that I own this house somewhere that I don't want to live.
Once, Christensen moved to a friend's house for 2 weeks, only to realize she couldn't afford her half of the mortgage and rent. Another time, her ex, Joel Nirenberg, packed up his car, planning to seek better jobs in California. Then unpacked, not wanting to leave Christensen in the lurch. Today, the two are still connected in all ways except marriage. They share a bank account for the house. They fix things together. They serve as each other's emergency contact. They're friends, and they even try to encourage the other's dating life, such as it is, they say.
In the process of seeing somebody new, do you bring this up?
Like, is that a first date deal breaker, or do you wait till your third date and bring it up nonchalantly? Oh, by the way, I'm still living with my ex-fiancé. My wedding dress is in his closet. But it's no big deal, really.
Right.
We're friends.
Yeah, good luck explaining that to somebody.
The issue of the house haunts them daily, and neighboring homes continue to drop in price.
Sometimes I see pictures of when we lived in an apartment together, and I just think, oh, if I still lived there, I could just drive away right now.
Several states away, Stephanie Blair is also stuck in her home, but with very different consequences. Blair lives in Montrose, Colorado. A year and a half ago, her husband lost his construction-related job and moved 900 miles away to take a job in Texas. She stayed behind with their two children to try to sell their home.
We find that 18 months later, we still have a house to sell. He's been living in our RV in Texas, hoping that someday we'll be able to join him. Our realtors recently told us that there's just no way that our house is going to sell, and we're stuck.
The realtor said the only hope would be to slash the $400,000 price in half, a huge loss they can't afford to take. Blair is considering renting it, though that might only cover half the mortgage. She's also discovered that the house trap has all sorts of other hidden costs. Plane tickets are expensive, so is maintaining two separate homes. And Blair had to give up her part-time work because her husband wasn't around to look after the kids.
Families are used to helping each other out, and we're just not able to do that from 900 miles away.
Christina Glad-Peterson wants to sell her Riverside, California home. Her husband wants a better job, and they both want to start a family, but not until they can live closer to their Midwestern families. But all of that is off the table because their current house has lost $40,000 in value.
I constantly think about it. I was just looking at the numbers this weekend, and I have to tell myself, you know, if we can hunker down for 3 to 5 years, which sounds like an incredibly long period of time, hopefully the amount that we owe on our house will go lower, and hopefully the value of our house will grow higher. And so we can perhaps break close to even and move on out of here.
Peterson knows she's not alone. All around her, houses are for rent and for sale, and there are few takers. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
For more on this series, and if you have a story to share about being stuck in your home, visit npr.org.